Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Hybrid Jazz is a vision of all that is jazz, both traditional and contemporary, domestic and global. Here's your host, Trish Hennessy.
Well, Dave Solomon, thank you so much. You know, sometimes when we start this show, if you can hear me exhale, I mean it with all of my heart, because sometimes the mornings leading up to the show's beginning are so busy that I finally have a chance to breathe. So, I am breathing right now. Thank you, Jesus, for the ability to breathe. Oh, my. Hope you are doing well today. Thanks so much for joining us here at Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. This is going to be the length and breadth of jazz this very day, my friend. Oh, yes, indeed. First of all, B.G. Adair, who I have known of for years, she has such a lineage of musical history, you are not going to believe it. You are not going to believe who this glorious pianist has played with and for and what she has created in the volume of work. She is known throughout the world as one of the finest keyboard players that ever walked. We're celebrating another one of those. George Duke. The passing of George 1 year today. You'll hear a lot of George Duke music, and you'll hear the kinds of tunes that popped when he was part of the project. And you know what? We're going to start off with one right now. You remember back in the 80s, maybe you don't, but you have since, matter of fact. The discography of Miles Davis is just insanity. Back in 1986, Miles was trying to be reflective of the music of the times. A lot of people took issue with what he did. But he was under the influence of a lot of people who were really catching buzz. One of those was George Duke. George produced a track on Tutu, named in honor of Archbishop Desmond Tutu, in 1986. This is Miles Davis and wonderful company, including George Duke, on Backyard Ritual on Hybrid Jazz.
Thank you.
Sunday evenings, the fun we used to share. Looking through the memories in my mind. Since I've laughed and cried and thought it over, now I realize that it's never over, only set aside. Oh, with you.
My mind keeps wandering, my thoughts are only you. Wandering through the memories in my mind. How could love so real have turned so empty? I just keep wondering why. Will I ever find the love we shared together, you and I?
Oh, with you.
To try and believe in what I say,
sweet baby, I will always be right there by your side, right by your side,
right by your side.
Good to the last drop, just like good coffee right there. It drops today, my old friend, celebrating George Duke, Al Jarreau and company, that time around, Layla Hathaway, of course. It's a star-studded event, that CD. Jeffrey Osborne, Diane Reeves, Gerald Albright, who you're going to be hearing a little bit later on in the show. Sweet Baby. Isn't that a great rendition? Oh, man. I'm feeling the love on that CD. Honest to goodness. And probably it's a carryover from Cap Jazz where they did a heck of a tribute. Whew! Man, a full house. And it just seemed like, I know that some think that I'm crazy for saying this, but George was so there It wouldn't have surprised me if he came down on earth for a couple of hours and was just wandering through the crowd. The spirit of him was so strong. A number of us talked about it. Just really amazing. Phew. Al Jarreau is going to be in Long Beach, California on the 10th of August, by the way, doing probably a number of these songs on the CD. Brazil afterwards, and Philly on the 21st. So Philly pals, make sure you're ready for George. Layla Hathaway is always busy. I'm not even going to get into that because that girl is always working. She was probably so tickled when she got the invitation to do My Old Friend. So special. George Duke, we heard the second song in that set, Phase 6, Love Theme, from Muir Woods Suite in 1993. Stanley Clark, Chester Thompson on drums, Paulina Da Costa on percussion, and this grand orchestra at the Montreux Jazz Festival, recorded on the 12th of July, 1993. George wanted to do a project, a musical work for orchestra, and like so many of his other projects, he got some heat because George knew so many genres so well that people got confused when they heard this work. It was just glorious. Matter of fact, that particular song, many have said, is a life-changing song. When you immerse yourself into this music from that particular album from then, and then you get to certain pieces, because they're all phases. Again, that was Phase 6, Love Theme. George was able to make this journeying kind of music a lot like film soundtrack music, but George, his brain was so much larger than most of us who have ever even given a thought to music. Can you imagine all that was in his roster? Funk and fusion and stone cold jazz and contemporary jazz and classical, that was his training. And then he would get into a different kind of zone entirely. The work he did with Frank Zappa, you'll hear another track coming up. I could go on for days. Oh, somebody shut me up. Miles Davis, we heard from Tutu in 1986, mirrored the R&B influences of the time, Backyard Ritual, the song that George produced along with Tommy LaPuma. Marcus Miller produced the other tracks. It was supposed to be originally Prince, but whatever. That kind of personality clash in the room, Miles and Prince? No, I don't see that working. It LaGonk's studio in West Hollywood, that's where that track was produced. All the others were recorded elsewhere, but that's the one we wanted to have focus because this is the first year anniversary of George having left us on August the 5th, 2013. We're going to make this as happy as we can, especially in light of the fact that our wonderful guest is coming up, B.G. Adair. And I wanted to see if we have time, because she's supposed to come up in mere moments. I want to see if we have time to do this. Let's just play B.G. Adair for this moment in time, because this is a 5.5-minute track. It should get us to the bottom of the hour very nicely. In light of the birthday that Tony Bennett had on the 3rd of August, turned 88 years young, this is going back in time, B.G. Adair from I'll Take Romance, and that's 2002. This is I Left My Heart in San Francisco on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Thank you. Man, I'm telling you what, it's just such a pleasure to hear someone who is an absolute master of their craft, no doubt about it. And this particular lady that you heard, B.G. Adair has been around for a long time. Matter of fact, I'm saving a story. She does not expect this whatsoever. There has been a foray back and forth in this long broadcasting career since 1976, and not all of it was jazz, as many know. Some of it was country. Most of it was country. So in living in Nashville twice, there were all sorts of folks that were in our midst when we were living there, and got to make friends with some folks who knew some other people. And it turns out that Nashville is this very small community in some ways where country music and jazz collide. Very interesting stuff. Larry Carlton can tell you all about that. But I got to know about B.G. Adair a long time ago. So there was something that happened when I was working in the 90s back in Nashville that totally threw me off guard in the best way, and I'll tell you about that. Miss Adair has not come to the studio yet, so what I'll do is I'll play another track that gives you an indication of the breadth of her scope on that piano. There is a touch that she has that nobody else seems to have. Now, mind you, she was born in Kentucky in the 1930s. So she's been doing piano for a long time. She learned when she was 5 years old. This was not that long ago. This is from I Love Being Here With You, a jazz piano tribute to Peggy Lee. This is Black Coffee on Hyper Jazz. Did I not tell you? Woo! What is it about some musicians who are so gifted? They probably know at an early age that there is a gift, or there's something that is intuitive in them to say, this is the direction that you must follow. There's something so soulful in this refined woman who has done piano work for so many and has been a leader with her own trio, etc., through so many years, decades of excellence in music. Born in Kentucky, moved to Nashville, where she really found her calling. And let me tell you, from the research that anybody could ever do on this magnificent artist, you'll find out that work came to her really quickly because people at that time, and you can imagine being a woman in the business, being a studio musician for WSM at that time, both radio and TV. And I think, having lived in Nashville twice, I can't keep up, so I can't really say that the radio is still kicking. I'm not sure what they changed the name to as far as the TV is concerned, but she can tell us. To be a female at that time and to have the kind of respect that she commanded, this is why I do this show in large part, so I can make sure that you realize the pioneers who paved the way for us in a multitude of ways. It's a pleasure to be able to give to you one of the premier pianists in the world. So glad to have spent a little time in getting to know her, and now she's on the phone with us, Miss B.G. Adair. Miss Adair.
Hi there.
Hi there.
Thank you for the kind words. Let me put a disclaimer in here, or a caveat. My house is being painted, and I have a very barky dog, and so I have had to leave the house.
She left the house, and
so
probably on
now around the side of the house, driveway. So people are passing by on the street outside, and I'm sure there's background noise, but believe me, it's a lot softer here than it is inside my house with the dog at this point.
So
I'm just trying to make do here so we can all eat. But I'm very glad to be here. Thank you very much. Those were very kind words.
You are so welcome. Look, you know what? If this
WSM
is a bad time.
Used to be WSM Television and WSM
right.
Radio.
Right.
Both are still there in a different form. WSM Television moved probably 35 years ago to a bigger and better location, slightly
yes.
out of town in the suburbs. But it the whole system became WSMV when everybody started having four letters instead of three. And it is still the it's Channel 4, and it's still the affiliate for network affiliate for NBC in New York.
And
so
yes.
They don't have live music on it anymore. Everything, of course, is all news all the time. But back then in the 60s, early 60s, they had several live TV shows a day and a couple of live radio shows. So there was a lot of work for several bands and groups of people to do. So that was kind of my intro into kind of the fabric of Music City in terms of the studio musicians.
Well, you know, Ms. Adair, I have to ask you this because having lived in Nashville twice.
When were you here? I'm curious. I think we must have run across each other at some point.
Oh, and let me tell you how much we ran across each other. We've never met, but do you realize that I have kept mementos through the years, and one of those mementos is from you. You sent me a postcard when you were from Franklin. It's on a blue postcard. This is what you said. Thanks for a great letter to the editor, Friday, January 10th. I've been griping about 16th Avenue for the last 10 years, just about the length of time it's taken to replace all of us old-timers with the Armani-clad Moost producers and musicians. When I was in England last year, the number one record in the whole country was Crazy by Patsy Cline. It's nice to hear my sentiments from you, a radio person. Keep up the good work. Maybe they'll get a clue. Regards, B.G. Adair.
Wait a minute.
Yes.
Is that what I said?
That is what you said, and you sent it to my home address because I had my home address in the Tennessean, and that's where you saw the letter. So thank you for
okay.
that.
Well, I had a lot going on in my life since then, so forgive me for not remembering that. Now, I lost contact with you there for a minute after I stopped talking, and I didn't hear the whole front part of what you were saying, so it just kind of cut out. So,
doggone it. Well, you know what?
There's some dead time there.
You
can edit it down, I'm sure.
Yes. You and I had shared a passion for what would be considered real music at that time. And I was lamenting about the passing of real country music in 1997, and you agreed with that. So
yeah.
I really appreciate that. And look, if this is a bad time, is this okay? Are you feeling comfortable?
Oh, I'm feeling fine. I was just worried that the background noise was going to be uncomfortable for the radio audience
no.
and for you. Okay.
No, not at all. How does a person like yourself, a female, start so strongly? You came to Nashville, and it didn't take long, did it, for you to get work coming from Kentucky?
Well, I got some work. I didn't get the good work for several years, but that happens with everybody when they come here if they're going to do a variety of things. I came here to go to graduate school, but I had been in Nashville weekends and during the summer a lot while I was in college because my college was only 60 miles north of town up in Kentucky, Western Kentucky University. And a lot of the musicians that I went to school with would drive down here on weekends to play dance gigs, weddings, society balls, that kind of thing. And I knew a lot of the guys in those bands, and a lot of those people also played in the TV and radio orchestras and things around town. So I met a lot of the older musicians, and I have to say they all treated me beautifully. They all treated me like I was their little sister and looked out for me and, you know, showed me where the coffee room was and just kind of showed me the ropes, I guess. And so I started working the first summer I came down to Peabody to do graduate work. I started working as a sub for Marvin Hughes, who was the piano player and director of a morning radio show on WSM, The Waking Crew. And he called me and said, you came highly recommended from some of my trombone players here and my trumpet player, and I need a sub for 2 weeks while I go on vacation. So I did, and that's how I made a connection to WSM. And then Marvin went on to do entirely. He became a record producer. And then I was on the sub list along with several other piano players, and we all knew each other. And back then, a lot of the work in Nashville came from other musicians. If you couldn't make a session, you were more likely to say, well, I know somebody who can play that, or I know somebody who can do that particular kind of thing. So a lot of it was word of mouth, and people were less competitive, I think, than they are now.
Yes.
And we were all kind of a team. Everybody liked everybody. So all the piano players hung out together, all the bass players hung out together, and they kind of exchanged road dates and work and tips. And, you know, we met at the union, had coffee together. And so everybody knew everybody, and it was kind of a big, happy family up until about the early 80s, I guess. And then Hollywood came in and took over, and all of a sudden it was like the budgets went up, and they had to have six sessions to do one single because they had to take 6 hours to get the drum sound. Which didn't improve the drum sound, by the way.
Right,
and,
right.
So the era of people being in the same room and recording at the same time kind of was over at that point.
Mm.
We actually had Charlie McCoy and some of the mainstays in music here, and especially studio music. He and several guys started a once-a-year reunion of the pre-1980 musicians.
Oh,
so
my.
We would all get together on a Sunday afternoon at some restaurant and have barbecue and beer, and then they'd pass a microphone around, and people would tell stories. And we always had about 100 people at that thing. Everybody showed up, you know, talked about the good old days. And
wow.
The funny part was that it was true. After 1980, We got a lot of California musicians in. The prima donna factor went up much higher. And people started getting competitive. Some musicians would come into town and didn't make any effort to assimilate or be friendly with anybody, and they'd go directly up to producers and say, you know, I heard your last record, and I can sure play better than that guy you had on it. I mean, that was the attitude.
Oh, man.
There was a lot of, there were a lot of kind of backhanded things at that point. But it's kind of done a full circle now, because with the Americana movement, that's really helped to go back to that sort of acoustic sensibility and the idea of playing music with everybody in the same room at the same time and making music the way it's supposed to be made. In a file somewhere on a computer 3,000 miles away. So there's like a little underground almost. A lot of the radio stations won't touch it because country radio stations are very regimented. But the Americana movement is getting a lot of action from just the public, buying the records and listening to the music and all that sort of thing. And so it's kind of like the old days in some ways. It's kind of fun.
You know, I completely understand that because just you might have known it. There were a couple of times where I was there in Nashville, and as a matter of fact, the first time around was in the early 80s, and then the second time was in the mid-90s. But both, actually, a few of those opportunities all presented themselves to play Americana music or roots music. Matter of fact, the correspondence that I had with your assistant, she probably got a big kick out of it because my AOL address is Alternative Country Western Gal, which, yes, I certainly was. There was a Casey Country on Murfreesboro Road that was part of a radio collection. And then Miss Adair, I was working with Keith Bilbrey, who was over at WSM in the Grand Ole Opry studio there. And I was on Music Row, and we would have all of these gals and guys come in to do live music on the Interstate Radio Network overnight. What a treat that was.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, it's, things like that are cropping up everywhere.
Yes.
Different people are moving to town. It's not so segmented as it was. When I first came, the musicians were kind of divided into categories, at least by the people who hired them. And road musicians were all on the road. So the theory was that nobody would call you for a studio gig because they assumed you were on the road 365. And so there were society band musicians, and nobody thought to call them because they were society band musicians. But it kind of changed over the years because country music started using horns on some things and strings on stuff. And so a lot of instrumentalists moved here, really good ones. We've got wonderful, wonderful horn players and a big pool of violinists, cellists, violists, all that kind of stuff, who routinely play on records. And so the compartments that they would put you in are kind of amorphous now. Nobody worries about what category you're in. They just, if you do something they like, they might hire you to do that on their record. You know, it's just, it's a little more open to all the new ideas.
You are so amazing to me because I'm just looking as you're speaking and you're giving some history and bringing us up to snuff as far as music in Music City is concerned. Now, how was it that you were able to morph into those beginning jobs, which found your way to the Johnny Cash Show back in the late 60s, early 70s, and then Peggy Lee and Dinah Shore and Nat Adderley and Henry Mancini, Chet Atkins, et cetera. And then you find your way into a discography of over 100 projects. Could you possibly encapsulate your amazing career for us in some way? Because that's strong stuff.
Well, it's my theory that kids learn what they grow up with, and my family was musical. Nobody did it for a living, but we always had a piano in the house. My dad played guitar, and my mother sang, and she had good ears. She could sing harmonies, and she could plunk on the piano a little bit. And my grandmother, who oversaw the whole batch of us, made sure that I had piano lessons early on. I started taking piano when I was in the first grade. And I took it all through elementary and junior high school. And then when I went to high school, I was lucky to have, even in that little town, I was lucky to have a conservatory-taught teacher who had moved back there. And so I had a lady from Cincinnati Conservatory for 4 years, and she was dynamite. And she got me really interested in, because I could play by ear, and I thought it was fun. It's like Keith Urban has said, if a kid can play without looking at the music, it's like a parlor trick, and your family always wants you to do it. But then you have to go back and learn, you know, what it is you're doing. So she was the one that got me interested into the real thing. I mean, she put me on Bach and Start and Brahms and Chopin, and she drug us to, you know, state and regional and all kinds of festivals to compete with other kids from other parts of the state. And by the time I got to Western, it was like, okay, I'm ready. I want to be a music major. So I had a lot of classical education. But in the meantime, my mother and my dad had this vast 78 record collection, and we always had the radio on. So I listened literally to everything, because they played everything. My mother loved big bands and singers, and she liked Peggy Lee and June Christie, and she'd listen to George Shearing and Artie Shaw and Benny Goodman. And my dad listened to some of that too, but he also listened mostly to Western swing and country and blues.
Oh,
so he loved,
man,
Ernest Tubb and Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys and all that. So when I came here, I was very kind of disappointed that people would put you in categories.
Yes.
We don't expect you to be able to play any country music because you're a jazz player, which I'd done in college, of course. Well, I kind of grew up being a country player. The first song I ever learned when I was about 7 was San Antonio Rose. You know, and 'cause my dad and I played things like that. And going from one to the other, whether it's pop music or jazz or classical or whatever, was a good tool to have in your toolkit, because orchestra work is going to require a lot of that kind of stuff. I got a lot of work as a rehearsal pianist, where I had to do a lot of sight reading for dancers and things like that. So the more things you knew how to do, the more work you got. And that's,
sure,
I think that's why I had, I just felt like I was always in the right place at the right time. And they'd say, who can do so-and-so? And I could say, I can. Okay. Sit down. Do it. You know.
That makes sense.
And going from one style to another is just, to me, it's like falling off log. I mean, I like it all, you know. And I noticed that a lot of the instrumentalists, like the horn players especially, you know, move very easily from one instrument to another and one style to another. And we all privately have a can do that better than anybody, because they have to improvise all the time. So if you want a really good country rhythm section, you get a jazz bass player and a jazz drummer, and they'll swing you out the front door, you know. It's true.
Yes. Yes.
As a matter of fact, my bass player on my records, Roger Spencer, who is like just one of the gods of bass playing to me. He's like, I've worked with Bob Cranshaw and a bunch of people like that, and Roger is right up there with the great people. He's a wonderful, wonderful musician. But one of his first gigs at 16 was playing at the Bean Blossom Bluegrass Festival in Indiana, tapping the bass. You know, so he agrees with that whole premise there. And most of the people do. The more things you know how to do, the more work you can get.
Well, and not only that, but with you, it's just the beautiful irony of you is that having known about you for years and having listened to various works that you've done, and there's so many, you give the appearance, this beautiful woman who is so refined, and you can crank out blues on that keyboard and surprise a lot of people. The element of surprise is always there in B.G. Adair. I love this. And, you know, hearing the breadth and the character of your work, it really does set you apart, and it's because of all that immersion factor that you had when you were little. How cool was it that your parents loved everything? Gosh.
Well, it was fun. You know, I grew up in an era when we didn't have television until I was a freshman in high school. And so, but we had radio all the time. And
yeah.
My mother had a little, you know, a little Crosley radio sitting in the window in the kitchen. And then at her office at my dad's service station in Tire Center, a couple of blocks away, she always had a radio in her office while she was doing the book work, accounting and stuff. And so when I came home from school, I went straight to where she was at work and then waited until she got off. So I did my homework to whatever she had on the radio. And it was just, you know, all through our lives. That's, my dad was crazy about music. I don't think there was ever a time in his life, even when he was in assisted living, that he didn't have music around him because he loved it. The first thing he wanted us to be sure and move was his little CD player and his CD collection so he could have all his music at the assisted living place that he went to at the age of 92. He was still listening to, you know, all kinds of stuff, including me.
That's so beautiful. Including?
Well, by that time I had some albums out, you know, and so he would, I would bring him, you know, right away when we had a new album out, I'd bring it to him, and he was real proud of all the things that I did, so.
Oh,
he had a collection of my stuff, too. But, you know, I know people that grew up in houses with no music at all.
I know.
Except for whatever's on television or something. And I never understood that. Part of it, I think, is just the time we grew up, because it was a little simpler time in some ways. And people just had radios around all the time. You know, we heard, that's where we heard the news and everything. But the radio back then was really good because they played stuff all over the map. You could hear it.
Oh,
and everything else.
Yep. My grandfather.
Just, you know.
I'm hearing an echo there, which is why I'm paying attention to what you're saying. There's a little bit of an echo, so I'm holding back.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather had an upright Philco that he had in the center of the living room in his house. So it would not only pull in radio programs for everywhere, but it was also a shortwave radio. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, that's a big part of childhood memories for a lot of us. So what you're saying here is something I relate to. Of course I'm going to ask you, I know that time is a factor and I'm not going to keep you too much longer, but you and I have this bond about radio. Tell me about improvised thoughts, Miss Adair.
Oh, and please call me BG.
Okay.
Well, that's a show that Greg Lee, who is the director of WMLT Radio on Middle Tennessee State University campus, which is our nearest and dearest local jazz station, 24-hour jazz
mm-hmm.
station. Well, they've gone from 24 hours back to, I think it's all through the night now from 7 on. And now it's partly news and partly classical, but it's still the best place in town to hear jazz. And but back when it wasn't a 24-hour station, which was in the early, late 90s, I guess, he came up with the idea because we were friends and he had announced and introduced us several times at little festivals and things. And everybody was, all the jazz musicians were friends of his. So he came up with the idea for an interview show by musicians and for musicians. And he asked me to, if I wanted to be the moderator or be the interviewer. And I said, well, I don't know. I've never done that before. And he said, and my husband famously said, he knows I like to, he knew I like to talk. And he said, nobody ever failed to have a conversation with you. So do it.
That's great.
And, so we did a few. When we started out, it was mostly bringing people in from locally. The university is in Murfreesboro, which is 30 miles south of us. And so we would bring musicians from Nashville or groups, vocal group, or groups of people maybe that had done a certain thing or all played in a band or interview a whole rhythm section or something like that. And then they put fiber optics in the telephone system at MTSU, and we were able to get very clear signals everywhere in the world on the telephone. And we started doing the things at the studio there. Greg would hook us up. I would put on earphones, and he would put on earphones, and then somewhere in the United States or even in England or France or someplace, somebody else would be on the other end of the phone line, and we would do a one-hour interview show. Usually with somebody that had a current new album out or something that they wanted to promote, or some historical, somebody like Jimmy Rolls or Gene Harris or Tony Bennett or somebody that was really an icon. And but we would do about five or six selections out of whatever they wanted to us to play, and Greg would go back after the conversation and edit. We'd leave edit points, and then he would put in the music in post-production. So it came across as a seamless, well, we're talking to so-and-so, and now we're going to stop and listen to his or her new record. It's track number 3, and it's called such-and-such. And then
Beautiful. We
would play it. So it started at the top and went seamlessly for an hour, seeming to be a conversation, but it was done in little pieces and mostly done on the phone. But they've reinstituted it. Greg has saved them all through all the changes that the station went through, and he jealously guarded them. I think they've been in big boxes in his garage or something. But we have something like, I don't know, 7 or 8 years worth of 3 one-hour shows. And so they are now airing on Sunday nights on WMOC at, I think it's 7 o'clock. And then they're
That's
making noises
incredible.
About, you know, streaming and all that sort of thing. So we may get them out in the world here one of these days.
Oh, BG, that's so exciting. Look, anything I can do to promote that, I'd be glad to do it.
Well, I know Monica's working on it, my assistant, and she, Greg met last week. And so I think there's some things going on. I stay out of all that because I'm so bad at electronics and detail. I have to have somebody just hold my hand and say, sit here, say this, you know. But
well, you're doing a good job.
You know, they're talking about syndication. They're talking about maybe doing CDs of some of them. We've talked about putting the interviews in a book collection of some of them because we were able to get, a lot of people that we got are now no longer with us.
Sure.
But we've had Nancy Wilson, we've had Dave Frischberg, Jimmy Roll, lots of piano players, Jeff Hamilton, Helen Merrill,
oh.
Diane
wow.
Krall,
just
all over the board, you know. We've had people, and by and large, everybody was really nice and fun to talk to. Musicians love to talk about their music, you know, and so it was fun to sit down with these people, even by long distance, and have a chatter with them.
Well,
so I think it's a good collection.
Oh, for sure, and I'm so glad that you clarified that, because if there's an opportunity for folks to be able to listen, that's amazing. We had a gal yesterday when everybody knew that the time was almost here for you to be on the show today. Valerie Whitcomb, who I know in Nashville, wanted me to ask you this. You used to play at F. Scott's, and now that's no longer there. So you play at the Nashville Jazz Workshop, do you not?
Yes. Well, I play once a month there with my trio.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, regular, just a Saturday night, once a month. Thing. We've done that now. We're in the second full year of that. And the Nashville Jazz Workshop is a wonderful asset for the town and for everything, for the city, for music in general. It even made Downbeat, you know, 100 best places to play, because we get out-of-town people that come there and play. It's a tiny little, it's an auditorium, a performance auditorium for the school, but it's outfitted like a little bistro. When we do concerts there, they have 4 top tables. People are allowed to bring their wine or their whatever and we don't sell anything like that because it's a not-for-profit school, but we are allowed to spray it on the premises. So people bring their little hors d'oeuvres and a bottle of wine, and they have a night out and listen to live music. And we have really good video capability, very good sound and recording capability. So I've done a live album there, and a lot of other people have too. Pete Chrisley is working on his second live album right now.
Fabulous.
He's a saxophone player from California. And he's been here and done several live concerts, and then they take the best of the best and put it on an album. And we have great, as I said, video capability. We've done some live streaming, you know, for concerts. And, there's a lot going on over there.
That's wonderful to hear because I have so many friends in Nashville, and I'm constantly on them to make sure they keep me in the loop about what's going on because it really is Music City. It's not just country music. There's so many offshoots of varying kinds of genres in that town. People don't necessarily know about Nashville, but it's one of the thriving music towns in the world.
Well, it is, and the jazz community here is quite large. People are always kind of astonished by that when I go out of town and tell them that. But our big problem has been over the years that have never been the number of places to play jazz that there would be in New York or L.A. or, you know, even some of the other major cities like Seattle or St. Louis or whatever. Usually we would have one or maybe two clubs at the most that would be programming jazz. Because a lot of our trade is built on the tourist trade. And it takes the real love for music to go into having a jazz club because it can be costly for the first couple of years until it gets off the ground.
Of course,
but,
yeah.
There have been a couple of very successful ones here and that would have gone on and on had things like leases not expired or whatever. And we've always been able to fill the rooms for jazz here, but we just don't have enough rooms. Just a couple places, and that's it at any given time. But there are a lot of musicians here. As I said, horn players they're just, you can put a 35-piece band with a huge string section and lots of horn players together. The Broadway composers to do the road shows, and we get, Tennessee Performing Arts, we get every major Broadway show at some point, all the big ones. And the conductors always say they'd rather come here than anywhere because the stable of musicians is so strong. And the singers are so strong. They say they like it better than any place in the country.
Wow.
So they're here. Those people, you may see a guy that plays saxophone with Natalie Cole with the symphony, and he'll go out the next night and play with you know, like the old Everly Brothers band or something. I mean, everybody does a lot of different things.
Oh, I know, and that's one of the things I miss so much about being in that atmosphere. And look, BG, I'm not going to keep you any longer. I have promised Monica that it would be approximately 30 minutes, and I know that you've got a lot
fine.
To do.
Right now I'm enjoying just being outside away from the noise.
Oh, gosh.
But
it must
very
be.
Nice to talk to you.
It's been
really
very
like
nice.
To hear your show.
Oh, listen, today is a special day because you were going to be here, so I wanted to make sure that I played a song by you back-to-back with Duke Ellington and John Coltrane in a sentimental mood because that's the way I was feeling knowing that you were going to be here. So
well,
I have a song.
Nice to know.
Yes, oh, my gosh. You are so in the category of greatness that I have in my mind. You're one of those premier artists in the world that it's just terrific to even have a little time with you because our ties are so similar and your reputation is so incredible. That's priceless. Do you have a moment? Yes, isn't it? It's really.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I have lots of time. I have lots of time.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. What is one of those defining moments that you've had in this beautiful journey of music. What was a time that you can recall that still, when you contemplate it, takes your breath away?
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Well, some of those, I mean, there's things that I would, if I was going to write a book, I keep threatening to, that I would write about. But one of the things that really has always intrigued me, because I didn't get very far from home. I mean, my hometown is 90 miles from here, and I kind of came to Nashville and stayed. A lot of my friends went to New York or went to California. But by staying here, and because of the music industry, I think, I actually got to do a lot of things I might not have been able to do in a bigger town.
Yeah.
When I was really young and wanting to go to New York, I realized that when I look back now, I think, you know, I would have just gotten lost like a little bug in New York City at that point, because I wouldn't have known how to get along. Now I do up there. I love New York, but it's a different place. But I came here and was made to feel welcome for the most part, and then I got things like with the Johnny Cash Show. I started out as a rehearsal pianist, and then the orchestra conductor hired me as his second. He was a piano player too, but he wanted to stand up and conduct and write and play all of the shows in the orchestra. And for that reason, I got to rehearse with the people that were going to do that. So that's how I met Peggy Lee and Tony Bennett and all these people that had to rehearse with the orchestra. Because the first thing they do is go check with the piano player, you know, can we do this, that, and the other, whatever. And,
absolutely.
So those things, it was always fun for me to meet people that I had read about or loved, you know, for so many years. And I got to hang out with, I did a couple of albums with Al Hurt. I did a couple of albums with Perry Como.
Oh, boy.
And I did a bunch of concerts with Henry Mancini, and I did a country album with him. It's called Mancini Country. And he played piano, and I played Hammond B3 on that record. And he was wonderful company. He was such a great composer, and he was a really funny guy. And I used to look back on those things and think, you know what? It's almost like this before we used the bucket list term, but it was like these are people I grew up liking, and all of a sudden I've gotten to meet a lot of them, you know.
How about that?
A little mental checklist. You know, I got to meet and work with Steve Allen, who was a big idol of mine. And
love him.
Carol Burnett, who was just, we compared, we both had a cyst on our right foot from, hers was from playing tennis and dancing, and mine was from the piano pedal. And we both had the same cyst on our foot. Yeah. We found that out at lunch one day when I was rehearsing her and the dancers. And, I got to work with a lot of local people that I really, really liked, like Dolly Parton. I've worked with her off and on, you know, television shows and stuff. And a lot of people that just, you know, we all knew each other by sight. I've worked a lot of, like, little outdoor festivals and country music celebrations, that kind of thing, with Brenda Lee. Those things where somebody comes up and says, you know, I'm just going to do two songs, and here they are, and we don't rehearse, we just do them. And she's like the mistress of being prepared. She is so wonderful. She's so musical. And all she has to do is come up and she counts the band off. She's very take charge. And she says, I'm going to do two choruses in C, and then I want you to play for 16 bars, and then I'll come back in at the bridge, and we'll tag it once and go out. And that's what she does. There's never any doubt of who is in charge of the song. She just, like I said about the other guys, she'll swing you out the front door. So those people have been, it's been wonderful for me. And other than that, I would say that one of the things that really knocked my socks off was getting to be a Steinway artist in 2002. And that was, for me, that was a big deal. I mean, I started out on a piano that used to be a player piano. And I fell in love with Steinway when I went to college. And, of course, they're very expensive pianos. They last forever, but they are, I mean, it's like buying a house or a car to buy a Steinway.
Oh, yeah.
And to be a part of that, you know, that family, because they're pretty specific about who they allow on that roster, and it was really a big, big, big honor for me.
And they only have a handful, I mean, well, more than a handful, but they do carefully select who they want to represent them. So that is a major coup if someone is tapped by Steinway to tout. They're the best in the business. Lost you. Okay.
Oh, this is garbage. I mean, that way, they'll take it, but you have to put it down away from the garbage can, I think. Like just down the side there. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I love it. It's live radio. We love it.
My house painter is they had to cut down some shrubbery in front of my windows, which we're going to replace anyway. And he was asking me what he does with what they cut down.
Oh.
I don't know if the garbage people are going to pick it up or not. They might. One of the recycling programs will. It's a circus around here.
Well, you know what? It sounds terrific, though. I mean, because it just adds to the ambiance of you and I speaking. I'm going to ask you one more question about the Bebop Co-op, because I really want you to tell me a little story about that.
Oh, that's a long time ago.
I know.
Well, we never had a record out. We actually have a record in the can, which is from about 1987. But we never... You know, we never did anything with it. That was that we formed when we all worked at a jazz club in Green Hills called Chick Place. And Chick was John Cicatelli, who ran, it was basically a little bar and grill, but he was from up east, and he'd always worked in bars with jazz, and he loved jazz and knew a lot about it. And he always wanted to open a jazz club, so he did. And he was, I have to say, except for maybe the guys at Birdland in New York, which is just the most comfortable, wonderful club in the world to play in. Chick was probably our other favorite club owner of all time.
Hmm.
The first thing he did was everything right. He, first of all, he knew he wasn't going to make a living for about 3 years. Wasn't going to break even for about 3 years. He had done all his homework, and he had been a food consultant for a big fast food company, and he knew what he was doing. And so his wife was the cook, his son was the busboy and one of the cashiers, and his daughter was a waitress and one of the cashiers. Everybody did two or three things. And they got a little house over on a little street in Green Hills that used to be residential, but it was being turned into little, you know, gift shops and jewelry stores and things. And so they opened up a bar in the front and a restaurant in the back that held about 100 people, and the first thing he did was call all the band leaders that he knew in town, and everybody knew him. He'd come to festivals and outdoor concert series and things like that all the time, and we knew him to be a friend of music, and the first thing he said was, I want to do everything right from the top down. I want to get totally straight with the union. I want to pay some kind of decent scale. I want to do everything you want me to do. And we made a list. And we said, you got to have a real piano instead of a keyboard. Check. And it has to be tuned and kept up. You have to have a decent sound system. And, you know, just be and have some kind of policy, like people really can't yell and scream and throw beer bottles in this place. It's for listening. And he ran a tight ship, and he did everything right. It was a little hole in the wall. It had linoleum on the floor, and they had great food. It had a limited menu of Italian pastas and sandwiches and just little things that were really well made. And he had a nice bar in the front, and so people could sit at the bar for no cover and just have a drink and hear the music through the door. And then if you came into the back to hear music specifically, you paid something like $2 in cover charge.
Wow.
And it was never more than $3, I think. And then he had the menu that you could order from, and then you paid, you know, that tab separately. And he kept up with everything. He tuned the piano every time it needed tuning. He made sure that all of the sound equipment was perfect. He played jazz over the loudspeakers when we weren't playing. And when you walked in, you were just immersed in this wonderful music and food the whole time. And nobody was talking too loud. And the leader, I mean, the, club owner, who sometimes was the bad guy in musicians' lives, he was always like on our side. If something was wrong, we could go to him and say, we really need such and such, you know. And they were there for 3 years. He was starting to make a profit, and his wife became very ill. And then his landlord, because it was an up-and-coming neighborhood, didn't want to renew his lease because he wanted to tear the property down. So they had to leave. But it was, for 3 wonderful years, I think I worked there almost every Friday night. And the Bebop Co-op grew out of that club. George Tidwell and Dennis Soley were the leaders. George is the trumpet and flugelhorn player. Dennis is the tenor player, multi-reed player. And Jim Ferguson playing bass, Bob Mader playing drums, and me. And a new trombone player in town at that time, Barry Green, who's now a well-established studio musician. But George wrote a lot of the charts. Dennis wrote some of them. Sometimes we just play tunes, but it was an actual, you know, structured band with arrangements that were our own kind of thing. And it was basically, it started out as the part-time, big-time bebop co-op. And that was because one of the more rancorous people in our community had said at some point on the air that he was the only jazz musician that worked out of town and was a full-time jazz musician, because everybody else played weddings and funerals and just played jazz as a hobby.
Whoa.
Which, of course, wasn't the truth.
Right.
So when George wrote a tune, a little bebop tune about it, and called it the part-time, big-time bebop co-op, he said, I guess since we're not really jazz musicians, we'll just have to be a part-time thing. So then it just shortened to bebop co-op. And it was
I
a co-op.
Love it.
I mean, we all had an equal part of everything, you know. We had an equal say, and we all made equal money. And it was run like a co-op. So
that is
at some
so
point,
amazing.
We went into the studio and cut, I don't know, 6 or 7 tracks, really good ones, a lot of instrumentals, I mean, a lot of originals, and several other famous jazz tunes and stuff. And it was a good set of tracks, but we never, at that point, we didn't have the internet, we didn't have marketing, we didn't have anybody that could back us, we didn't have anything. So everybody just went home with the tape and enjoyed it on their own, and that was the end of it. But it's still good, it's still viable. It'd be fun to put it out one of these days.
Oh, it sure would. And maybe if the push is on for making sure that folks listen to you on that radio station on Sunday nights, maybe that could happen, because a lot of people would scoop that up, BG, honest to goodness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the instrumental, all of the instrumentalists on this album, you know, have gone on to play on other albums that have been out in the world from Green Hill Music and otherwise, because they're the three horn players on that band were, I would say, they are the top of their section in any band. In terms of ability and stuff, they are the cream of the crop. They would always sell. Dennis, the tenor player, has done, I think he and I have done 4 albums together. One with strings, coupled with the trio, Dennis and the trio, and at least one Christmas project that he and George have played on. So they're out there in the world. You know, people have heard them. But it would be kind of fun to go back and visit that project.
Oh, it definitely would. And I have to say, I mean, you're waxing poetic about all these beautiful people that you have played next to, and what a blessing that has been. But the fact of the matter is that you were part of that greatness. You are also so unbelievable and have surpassed, no doubt, your parents. I could only imagine what was going on in their heads, seeing you morph into this butterfly and just delighting them, picking up all of the influences that they gave you. They didn't deliberately give you the influences, but they just loved music so much, and you were this sponge. So now I just want everything in the world to happen to you. If you can get another accolade, if you can get more attention, BG, I want it to happen for you because people have to know the amazing history that you've had.
Well, thank you very much. But I'm fond of saying, you know, I guess this is my grandmother coming out because she always said, "Dad, don't be ugly, be sweet, you know, always be nice to people." But, you know, she had a very clear set of principles she lived by. And so I'm always thinking when I say something that's kind of self-aggrandizing, I guess, I'm always thinking, you know, there were a lot of other people that helped me do that, whatever it was. And so I have to say I was very lucky all the way along the way because I met some people, like mentor kind of people, who were older than I and had been in the business for a long time, who really, really helped me and brought me along. And so a lot of the credit goes to them, starting with my parents, of course, but band leaders I've worked with and other musicians I've worked with, I've learned an incredible amount from other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the fun part of jazz music is that everybody's learning from everybody else, you know.
Oh,
you
yeah.
You keep your ears open. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you've made so many strides for so many women, and I have to mention that again. And I love, this is not that long ago. I'm going to make sure that you get back to your house, and then I want to lead this out with something from The Real Thing live. I love this song, BG, The Lamp Is Low, the way you do it. I love it.
Oh, thanks. We get a lot of requests for that.
I'll bet you do. Yeah, it's just something special. Tell me, tell anybody who's listening live or in the archives later who you're playing with. And I know that you have a great deal of love for those musicians that surround you, but this is really special, this CD.
Well, on this CD is my rhythm section, which now I've had for about 20 years, and that is Roger Spencer on the string bass and Chris Brown, who's from Albuquerque. Roger's from Terre Haute. We all met here because of the music business, and I've played with lots and lots of jazz musicians in festivals and things, and lots of big ones and really wonderful people that I've enjoyed playing with and always wanted to, but I've never found consistently any two rhythm section players for me that have so easily stepped into the way I want the trio to sound. They both have just incredible ears and incredible musicianship. And I'm very fond of saying to the audience a lot of times, if I didn't have these two guys here with me, I would not sound the same. I would sound like somebody else. Because it's really kind of, I call it the three-legged stool. You know, if one of us is not there and we use a sub, it's good, but it's not the real thing, you know. It's a sound that I've always wanted to have. I've had a lot of really good trios over the years, three or four of them, and all of them were superb musicians. These two guys are just it for me. Because if I raise an eyebrow, they don't miss a thing. They raise their eyebrow with it, you know. We just move like a machine now because it's been so long. We all hang out together a lot, and we talk politics and dogs and cats and things that we love and, you know, our lives and our houses and, you know, the plumbing's broken or whatever, but we're family. We're like family.
That's
so
beautiful.
They're it for me, and that's who's on The Real Thing.
Oh, well, now I love the project even more, thinking about all of that in the days to come. I appreciate the time that you took today, BG. It means a lot to have you here.
So much.
Yeah.
Thanks for giving me the chance to do this, and I hope we'll be in touch again.
I hope so, too. And now that my son and I are moving to Florida in December, we'll be that much closer to you in Tennessee.
Well,
so
yeah.
We'll come see you.
You should take a little detour and come through Tennessee, and then you can head south.
Absolutely. And where am I going to go? Nashville Jazz Workshop, that's for sure.
Right. Yes. And if people want to know more anytime or just want to look at what we've done or just they can always go to bgadare.com and then there's another website. I guess this is an email. BGFans@BGAdair.com.
Wonderful.
And
that's wonderful.
That's it. They can always get in touch with me, and we try to, you know, answer everything and make sure everybody's getting attention when they write or call in or mail in or whatever.
Well, you thank Monica for that, because she has been very efficient, and you have a Facebook page,
yes,
too, so that,
yes,
that's a big deal, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, I don't look at it as often as most people do, because I'm so bad on the computer, but I stay in touch with what it's saying and what's going on, and I vet everything as it comes across my desk, and she's very good about keeping things, you know, going like that for me.
Well, the help that is around you means so much, because your career has meant so much to a lot of people. So I'm just tickled that she's right there with you. Even though you might not be great on the computer, you're wonderful on the phone. So there.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, BG.
Travel safe to Florida, and if you can get through Tennessee, please do.
Oh, you know I'm going to now, because we have spoken, so there's one more reason why I must return. So you take care of that house, and I didn't hear any barking dog, which is a wonderful thing, so hope the noise level is down for you.
Yeah, I think the painters have gone, I think, for the day, and so he's quiet.
Good.
He's probably asleep now on the couch when I go back in, but
good.
I hope this wasn't too much of a strange thing here with all the background noise and the dump truck that went by and all that. But
no,
anyway, it was a very nice
just,
conversation
it
to be.
It made for more spontaneous conversation, so that's the key to this show. So it's going to be one of the more memorable shows that we'll ever have.
Okay.
Thank you, BG. You have a wonderful
all
day.
Right. Hey,
all right.
You too. All right.
Thank
bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye. BG Adair, oh, I knew it was going to be just magic like that, because the span of decades that she has been giving us music, if you want to see an astounding discography, you do your own research. BG Adair, BGIEADAIR.com has the information that you need. You'll have your mouth agape, as I did many, many, many weeks ago when I put this all together. This is, again, one of those tracks, The Lamp is Low, from a beautiful collection of work, The Real Thing Live, the BG Adair Trio, on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy.
love is here to stay. Not for all year, but ever and a day. Oh, the radio and the telephone movies that we know may just be passing fancies, and then time may go, but oh my dear, our love is here to stay. Together we going on a long, long way. In time the rockets may crumble, Gibraltar may tumble, they only made of clay. But our love is here to stay.
It's very clear our love is here to stay. Not for a year, but ever and a day. Just be passing fancies, and in time may go. But oh, oh, oh my dear, our love is here to stay. Together we're going a long, long way. In time the Rockies may Gibraltar may tumble, they're only made of clay, but our love is here to stay.
From Ella and Lewis again from 1957, their sequel, if you will, to the 1956 Ella and Lewis CD. Woo! Love is Here to Stay, George and Ira Gershwin song, which never sounded finer, not only because of the vocal abilities of Ella. Louis was always a character when he sang, no mistaking him for anybody else. But they also had Herb Ellis on guitar, Louis Belson on drums, Oscar Peterson on piano, and Ray Brown on double bass. You combine that with the palpable chemistry that those two stars had, just amazing. Beautiful stuff. Oh, if you can get a hold of that CD, there's a lot of songs on there too, so see if you can do that maybe for the upcoming weekend and really relax. really put yourself into the atmosphere of what B.G. Adair called the ambience of that club that she was describing in Nashville and Green Hills. Man, that was something else. You were immersed in the jazz scene as soon as you walked through the doors, because when the band was not playing, there was jazz over the PA system. That's the way to do it. We also heard Duke Ellington and John Coltrane. Another one of those pairings that people will be talking about long after we are gone. 1963, in a sentimental mood, on Impulse Records. Their backgrounds, their styles, their age, all different, but there was something so magic when they recorded those sessions in late September, close to John Coltrane's birthday. And the song itself has another little story, because Duke Ellington was saying that they were playing in Durham, North Carolina, way back. And this was a tobacco warehouse they were playing. So you can imagine that none of the big halls that Duke was so used to. He was born with a silver spoon to a very large extent and played some fine houses. This was not one of them. So apparently, in order to sort of diffuse an argument that one of the guys had with two gals, Duke Ellington composed that song on the spot with a gal on either side of the piano. As he was playing it, he was composing it. Crazy. And now, look at the song. One of the treasures that we have that was ever conceived. Beautiful. B.G. Adair. How about that, huh? That was 7 minutes of bliss from The Real Thing Live, the B.G. Adair Trio from just a couple of years back. Again, you have to go to bgadair.com and check out the discography on this woman. I'm almost speechless, because it was just so much fun to have her. She stayed longer than anticipated. I was told in no uncertain terms, 30 minutes. I think she was fine with the time that she had. We've got some new music. We've got to get to all of this stuff. We really do. Let's play, first of all, because I want to play this next to Willie Bradley. Willie Bradley and Rob Maletek and some others that we'll hear, if not today, on Thursday, part and parcel of this big Christian Dimasones event at K2 in Woodbridge, Virginia. I could go on about the food, but more importantly, the music was off the chain. So Willie is coming up with his take on a Bobby Caldwell classic after Reagan Whiteside, Frank McComb, and Bob Baldwin, and Smoky Room from Reagan's brand new Quantum Drive on Hyper Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Thank you.
Everyone who
Oh, let it play. Let it keep on playing. Woo! Mercy, one of my favorite songs ever. Ever. You know that's George Duke, right? Yeah, almost unrecognizable in some ways, but not in others. 1974. Frank Zappa had given up his studio time so that George could do a CD. Well, not in those days. We didn't have them. An LP, a cassette, a reel-to-reel. Oh, man. So that was the talk of the industry, that Frank Zappa had given up his studio time for George Duke. Everybody knew how much Frank thought of George. And Frank was responsible. George said this himself. And when we last spoke to George in 2012, monumental interview. Oh, my gosh. If you can dig that out of the archives. If Blog Talk Radio doesn't have the third-party sponsors that drown out the audio, by the way, that's another subject entirely. Yeah, trying to sort that out. If you can catch the interview where you can hear it and it doesn't jar your ears from the commercials, that's a lot of substance that George gave me that day, talking about the absolute inspiration that Frank gave him, bringing him out from the keyboard, making him sing, when George really was kicking and screaming at the notion. Frank said, no, you have to. You got a lot inside you. You got to get it out. Thank you, Frank. Man, I hope that you're with George. I'm very certain that George is up there looking down. I'm not so sure about Frank, but I'm just going to give heaven the benefit of the doubt and say that they're both together. Love, the name of that song. Two stints with the Mothers of Invention. I think you know about that. On this particular album, by the way, Leon Indugu Chankler and also Flora Purim. Just magic music. Feel from 1974. We heard Willie Bradley. Oh, this man, Another Day in Time. Trumpeter Willie Bradley. That was out last year. Willie was at the event, the big shindig that Christian Dimasones threw for his All-Stars. Willie just tore that joint up. What you heard was Bobby Caldwell's What You Won't Do for Love. He's making plans to be on Hyper Jazz soon. What you need to know about the CD is that the executive producer was Willie, but the producer was Nicholas Cole. A lot of songs from Nick here, and Lynn Roundtree making sure that he got his dibs in, as well as Marcus Anderson. So you might want to check out some really seasoned sounds. What I'm saying by seasoned is, I don't know how old of a person Willie Bradley is. He looks ageless to me, but you should know that he not only earned his degree in music education, he paid his dues. He has been involved in both contemporary and traditional jazz, and at one point he was playing with both Betty Carter and Dizzy Gillespie. So that's what you need to know. Yeah. And we heard Reagan Whiteside from Quantum Drive, Smoky Room, with Frank McComb and Bob Baldwin. Reagan's going to do her CD release party coming up really soon on the 7th. Yep, you might want to check out ReaganWhiteside.com and find out. I'm looking at all these dates here. Shoo! Bob Baldwin's going to be in North Carolina with Willie Bradley on the 23rd of August. That's so cool. And Frank McComb is playing a lot of dates in Texas and Georgia, so look them all up. There's so much music that you can see live. Please support when possible. Please. What are we going to do now? Oh, I'm just so excited. We got to do it. We got to play something by Christian Dimasones. He mentioned this at the gig at K2 in Woodbridge, Virginia on Saturday. I probably knew this, but I guess that I was the first ever to play a Groove School track in the world. And apparently this song from Limited Edition, the Groove School Band album, did monumentally well in some parts of Europe. This is Latin Jive on Hybrid Jazz. It's taken its time to get there. I don't know what the story is. Oh, Lord. Okay. We'll go to plan B then. Isn't this crazy? All right. We'll go to plan B. And Hiroshima.
We'll be right back.
Hybrid Jazz. Beautiful, huh? Woo! Merciful heavens. Out today, Mr. Guitar, our guest from last week, David P. Stevens, teaming up with someone, a fellow Philadelphian that he has wanted to work with for a while, and they got a chance to do it, Gail Johnson. Breath Away, the name of the song. Oh, that's going to do so well. That vibe is so sweet. Gail Johnson with David P. Stevens, Mr. Guitar. Look, the show has been mentioned today as being a little something for everybody. But David's album clarifies that in a whole nother level because he's got some tunes on there. He's got a little spoken word. He's got a little gospel. He's got certainly a lot of soul, jazz. He's got a tribute to Grover Washington Jr. with Andrew New. Man, it's really smoking. Please get a chance to pick up that CD. You can get it anywhere. David P. Stevens. He's one of those young men who can do almost anything. He's just got a real love inside of him. He's got a real balance because that's the way he was raised, and good family life, too. So it just makes the music seem warmer and richer. I don't know what is going on with David, but I can't be objective because he's from Philly. All right, time to get serious here. Got another song from a brand-new CD that is also dropping. So we covered Al Jarreau today. We covered David P. Stevens, and we're going to cover Gerald Albright. Gerald has done on this album Slam Dunk, which he means to suggest that a definitive place in your life where you are, where everything is brought to the table. He is thinking not only in basketball terms, but way beyond there. He's got a Cyndi Lauper tune on here. He's got a James Brown tune, and I understand that James Brown is really big with Gerald. He thinks about him a lot, and he hears Maceo Parker in his ear. Phil Collins had a hand in production of True Colors, the Cyndi Lauper song. He's got a song for George Duke, and you're going to hear George in this mix. You're going to hear Rob Maletek as well. Did a great job on Saturday night at K2 with Christian DeMissones and company. So it's going to be Gerald Albright first, and a track that immediately was close to me when I heard it. This is called The Gospel on Hyper Jazz.
Well, here I am again, sitting in front of this computer screen at 3 in the morning, paying some bills. And you come across my mind real heavy. And I want to reach out to you, you know, say something funny. Just say hello. I'd really like to call you, but it's late, so I think I'll send you an email that you can pick up in the morning. And I know I haven't seen you in a long time, but that doesn't mean my feelings aren't strong. And sometimes it seems we just go along from day to day, not saying the things we should say. But right here, right now, for me today, I want you to know that, girl, I
like a bird in the sky, above the mountain top on high, and like a lion that's let it roar, and like an eagle that's let it.
You know, even if he hadn't left us on this day last year, that song would still be monumental. What a beautiful song, Missing You, from George Duke's last work, Dreamweaver, 2013. So beautiful. And I got to make mention that it was a little tough to put songs together today, thinking, all right, got to have the right ambiance, and looking into the mirror and saying consciously, you are not going to cry on the show. And that is the truth. I'm not going to do that. We heard Rob Melotic, title track from his Back Home CD from 2006. Can't even say to you what Rob Melotic and Eddie Backus Jr. did on that stage on Saturday night with Elliot Levine and Willie Bradley. And my new friend Curtis, oh my gosh, I'll have to tell you more about Curtis in the days and weeks to come, because, you know, there were a few of those face-to-Facebook moments on Saturday night that were so cool. Curtis McCain was one of them. Jay Jones was there. Haven't seen him for a while. So many great people that were congregated to a sold-out crowd in Virginia that night for Kristen DeMasones. So happy to make note of that. Gerald Albright, we heard as well from his brand new Slam Dunk. And again, let's tell you a couple of surprises if you didn't already know about this new CD. Gerald is playing sax and bass and flute, singing a little bit too. He had some help from a co-pro, co-producer Chris Davis, who kicked it up a notch or two. And there are some songs on here that are going to make you sweetly gasp, "Oh, Gerald," because he was so serious about wanting to make this pop. So I saw via a YouTube video to announce the new project that he wants to get to different parts of the world in order to take this music there. And one of the methods for madness that he has in mind is that he wants to share a song on the CD called "The Duke" for George. Gerald loved George Duke, and George loved Gerald. So just by the mere fact that all of these friends who love George and his life so much carry on that vibe, because, you know, that big teddy bear was all about love, and you just can't help but feel it. When anybody gets into a groove that is all about remembering him, it's just L-O-V-E all over the doggone place. I am going to leave you with a song, another one from Dreamweaver. It just seems to be fitting, and I won't come on after I do this song. We'll tell you about who's going to be on forthcoming hybrid jazz shows, and we'll do that via Facebook and Twitter. We'll just let the song speak for itself. You can't help but wonder that George had in mind that this was going to be his last musical biography, autobiography, if you will, and he ended Dreamweaver with "Happy Trails," the Roy Rogers song. So listen in and remember, play some George Duke songs if you can today, and God bless you for listening. Thanks, Peach. You are always there, and I appreciate you so much. Griselda was here earlier. She had to go. Pete Gitlin was here. Various folks going back and forth. Jason Gorov saying some nice things on Facebook, and Kristen Dimasones as well. A lot of really excellent people who are going to get mentioned on the show over and over again. See you next time on Hyper Jazz.
I'll be back around. And I'll be getting down. And that piano for you, girl. But if you ever get lonely for me, girl, put that CD on. I'm gonna sing your favorite song. And if you ever get lonely for me, girl, push one of those numbers on that CD. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, or 10. And I promise you, ain't gonna be long, baby. No, it ain't, baby. It ain't gonna be long. We'll come back around. And let me just say, right here, right now, to someone special who's been in my life for a real, real, real long time. And if the words don't rhyme, they still gonna be on time. She's a special lady, and that's the truth that I had to bid adieu. But I know one day I'll see her again, and that's the truth. Love don't play by no rules. I want you to know, I wish you a happy trail, girl.
I wish you a happy trail, girl.
Yes, I do.
Happy trail.